Hello, this is Peter Fisher, and this is episode 8 of the General One podcast, which is about orbits. So today we're going to talk about orbits, or more generally, central force problems in classical mechanics. This is a very important topic for a number of reasons. First of all, it goes right to the heart of the origins of classical mechanics. It was Newton's explanation of planetary orbits, building on the work of Galileo, Kepler, and Huygens, that demonstrated that his theory of dynamics was, at least in some approximation, correct. It's to this day a very, very important topic in research in the structure of galaxies. Related to the orbit problem of orbits are unbound orbits, which are the root of scattering theory. And scattering plays a major role in both practical and theoretical physics. And so this is a topic really worthy of a specialty podcast. We're going to talk about central force problems, which are forces that depend only on the separation between the two bodies and whose vector is oriented along the vector connecting the two bodies. This is really the simplest and, in some sense, the richest in dynamics. But you should be aware that there are many, many other kinds of forces that act between particles. So starting off writing a Lagrangian for two point-like masses of m1 and m2 requires six spatial coordinates, three for each. So the Lagrangian is going to have two kinetic terms and a potential which connects the two bodies. So in the most brute force approach, you'd have to solve six Euler-Lagrange equations, which are coupled. Now, of course, considerable reduction is possible. First of all, one works in the center of mass coordinates. So we take one of the three of the coordinates as the vector that connects particle 1 and particle 2, and three coordinates as the vector that specifies the center of mass. And one thing you should drill on is determining the center of mass between two particles. It's not very hard, but it's important to know what the key points are and how to do it quickly. So the center of mass in the Lagrangian, the center of mass coordinates are cyclic, so they correspond to a conserved momentum, which is just the momentum vector of the center of mass. So the problem can now be cast in terms of two coordinates. In terms of three coordinates. And if one looks at the initial conditions, the separation of the two particles is given, and there's a velocity in some direction, and the force acts along the coordinates connecting the two particles. So there's no way for a force to create a change in momentum along the vector that's perpendicular to V cross F. And hence, the motion will always take place in a plane. This is pretty easy to prove, and you should just write down V cross F and convince yourself that this is true and know how to construct the argument. So now we're down to two coordinates, R, which is the separation between the bodies, and theta, which is the angle in the plane of motion with respect to some arbitrarily chosen origin of theta. And looking at the Lagrangian for that, there's a kinetic term, which is 1 half mu r squared, where mu is the, 1 half mu r dot squared, where mu is the reduced mass, and r dot is the time rate of change of the separation of the two particles. A second kinetic term is 1 half mu times the quantity r theta dot quantity squared. That's the kinetic energy associated with the motion in the theta hat direction. and then minus V of R, which is the potential. Looking at that, since the potential can only depend on R, the coordinate theta is cyclic, and there's a conserved momentum associated with theta, which is mu R squared theta dot. You get that from calculating dl d theta dot. That is the angular momentum, which we call little l, and that's also a conserved quantity. So it reduces down to really one equation of motion in R. And if you simply extract the equation of motion for R, you can write down a more general term, which we'll come to in a minute. But thing number one to really be sure you understand is the reduction of the problem from 6 degrees of freedom down to 1 degree of freedom. Before going into solving the equation of motions and talking about some specific example, it's important to go back and also talk about energies. The total energy of the system is 1/2 mu r dot squared plus 1/2 mu r squared theta dot squared plus the potential. Since the angular momentum is conserved, the second term, which is the kinetic energy in the theta hat direction, can be replaced by L squared divided by mu squared r cubed. So now there is a first term, which is 1/2 mu r dot squared, which is a kinetic term, and then two terms, one from the replacement of theta dot and the other from the potential due to the force connecting the two particles. This can be thought of as what's called a kinetic potential, the effective or the kinetic potential. The kinetic term is 1/2 mu r dot squared. The effective potential is U, or V, which is the potential associated with the force, plus L squared over 2 mu r squared. So it's useful to think of the total energy, which is given by a kinetic part and a potential part. The kinetic part is 1/2 mu r dot squared plus 1/2 mu r squared theta dot squared. And the potential part is just V of R. And the force is, of course, minus dV dr. Now, what's important is to realize that the theta dot can be substituted in for by the angular momentum. So the second term, which corresponds to the kinetic energy in the theta hat direction, is L squared over 2 mu r squared. So now if you look at the energy, there's a first term that depends on r dot, and the rest just depends on r. So that second two terms can be thought of as a potential. Part of it is potential from the force. The other part is potential from the conserved angular momentum, and that's referred to as the kinetic potential. And so the kinetic potential is Vr plus L squared over 2 mu r squared. Now, depending on what you're asked, you want to either look at the equation of motion that you get from the Lagrangian, which is now just depends on R, or the energy. So if, for example, you're asked to find the turning points, which are the apogee and perigee of the orbits, what you want to do is understand what a turning point is. A turning point is the closest and furthest away that the particles get. And those two points occur when the motion along the R direction is zero. So one can easily find the turning points by setting R dot equal to zero and solving. And the equation that you solve will solve for, and just by solving. So now looking at the expression you get when you set R equal to zero, R dot equal to zero, and solve for R, you may find that one of the solutions is infinite, which of course corresponds to an unbound orbit. If you find two finite solutions, that corresponds to a bound orbit. And this law is everything we've done so far is applicable to either a to any central force. Notice that the initial conditions are specified by the total energy E and the angular momentum L. So a classic problem is the following. Suppose you're on the space station and there's some, you want to get rid of some garbage. What's better to do? Send the garbage to deep space or send the garbage into the sun? So to solve this problem, actually let's make the problem a little bit more sensible. Suppose you're on Earth and you want to get rid of plutonium. What is easier to do in terms of amount of energy you need to provide? Send the garbage to deep space or send the garbage into the sun? So what you want, you solve this problem by thinking in terms of turning points. In one case, you need a problem, you need an energy such that one of the turning points starting from Earth orbit is infinite. The other, you want the turning point to be smaller than the radius of the sun. So you're going to need to calculate the initial conditions starting from Earth orbit for those two things and choose the one that's smaller. So that's an example of using energy to find turning points. Going back to the equations of motion, one can write down the equations of motion from the Euler-Lagrange equations in one dimension. And the way to solve the equations of motion is in two steps. First, make the substitution R is equal to 1 over U, so we can solve the problem using just in the coordinate U. And then, instead of solving U as a function of T, which is, of course, not possible, use the chain rule so that the problem you actually solve is a U as a function of theta. So putting that in, substituting into the equations of motion for U, and using the chain rule to change all occurrences of du dt to occurrences of du d theta will give you the following equation. U double prime plus U is equal to some constants times U squared times F of 1 over U. The constant is minus mu over L squared. So just to be, U double prime is the second derivative of U with respect to theta. So just to be a little bit specific about using the chain rule, you're going to have to find R double dot in terms of U derivatives of U with respect to theta. So if you start with R dot, well, that's equal to the time rate of change with d by dt of 1 over u. So that's going to be minus u squared u dot. U dot is du dt, and du dt is equal to du d theta times d theta dt, which is just theta dot. So you want to substitute L over mu r squared. And so that will get you the relation between r dot and theta prime, where theta prime is d theta dt. du d theta. So take the derivative again and just work through substituting L over mu r squared for theta dot using the chain rule. Be sure you know how to do that. Now, the equation that I just gave you, which is u double prime plus u is equal to some constants times u squared times f of 1 over u, we should investigate a little bit. It's completely general. Let's take the case f equals 0. In that case, you have u double prime plus u equals 0. And the solution to the problem is just u equal sine of theta or cosine of theta times some constant plus some phase. You should convince yourself that that's a straight line in the coordinates we're working, which are polar coordinates. Let me just give you a problem. Suppose a particle follows a trajectory that's a spiral, which is r equals some constant a times e to the k times theta. What force law does that correspond to? The classic application of this is Kepler's problem. In Kepler's problem, the force is equal to some constant divided by r squared. So let's call that constant k. So you have u double prime plus u equal to some constants times the force, which is k times u squared divided by u squared. So the general form of the differential equation is u double prime plus u equals a constant. And that has a solution, which is u equal to constant times the quantity 1 plus epsilon cosine theta. So then r is equal to alpha divided by 1 plus epsilon cosine theta. And that's the classic orbit solution. Epsilon is the eccentricity of the orbit. If epsilon is equal to 0, the orbit is circular. If epsilon is between 0 and 1, the orbit is elliptical and bound. If epsilon is equal to exactly 1, at cosine theta equal to pi over 2, cosine theta equal to plus or minus pi, the denominator diverges. And if epsilon is greater than 0, the denominator diverges for smaller values of theta, and that corresponds to hyperbolic orbits that are not bound. Epsilon equal to 1 corresponds to parabolic orbits, which are of course bound. So you know this, and this is something you should just memorize. One thing that's important is how to find epsilon quickly, because you may be given a problem with some initial conditions, and you want to convert those initial conditions to an energy and angular momentum, and then find the orbit parameters. What you don't want to do is, you know, try to substitute in those initial conditions directly. The simplest thing to do is go back to the energy expression and use the fact that there are clear relations between the turning point, the parameter alpha, and the eccentricity epsilon. So the closest approach, which I think is the the closest approach, the minimum separation, r min, is equal to alpha times the quantity 1 minus epsilon. And R max is equal to alpha times the quantity 1 plus epsilon, where alpha is the semi-major axis of the elliptical orbit. You can solve for those two turning points in terms of energy and angular momentum using the energy expression. And once you have those, you have two equations, two unknowns, and you can convert them into expressions for the parameters of the elliptical or hyperbolic orbit in terms of energy and angular momentum, which is just exactly what you want. Another thing to know how to do is how to quickly extract Kepler's law, which just says that the orbit period tau is related to the semi-major axis alpha by the relationship tau squared is proportional to alpha cubed, there is a proportionality constant, which really isn't very interesting. And you should just, you know, drill through all the different relationships. For example, there's another Kepler law, which says that the orbit sweeps out equal areas per unit time. So learn how to find the area of a little segment of orbit and calculate how long that takes. But one of the main things you want to know how to do kind of quickly is extract the energy and angular momentum from the perigee and apogee quickly using the energy expression, or vice versa. So another important class of problems in orbits are sort of perturbation theory calculations, where one considers small perturbations around an orbit. So an example is the sort of classic throwing garbage out of the space station. Suppose one's on the space station in orbit around the Earth, and assume this is a circular orbit with the radius of 6,800 kilometers. And the astronauts, in an effort to get rid of some trash, just go to the airlock and put the trash in and just shove it out away from the Earth, find the subsequent motion of the trash relative to the space station. There are a couple different ways you can approach this. One way is you can calculate the change in energy and angular momentum, you know, to first order, expanding the square roots, and use that to find the change in eccentricity and semi-major axis, and then compare the two orbits, the circular orbit and the new elliptical orbit. The other way you can go about it is you can calculate, you can view the kinetic potential as a potential well with the space station sitting in the bottom, and then the garbage going rattling back and forth, sort of like a simple harmonic oscillator, and just calculate the period. Either one of those are perfectly fine approaches, and you should practice each one. Another phenomenon is to realize that what you're doing is you're calculating forces relative to the center of the Earth, with, for example, the Moon orbiting around. So the picture really is, you forget about the Sun for the moment. There's the Earth, and which is much more massive than the Moon, and the Moon is in orbit around the Earth, and you calculate the force on a patch of water relative to the force on the center of the Earth, because standing on the Earth, what you observe is the distance of the difference of those two forces. And so you should be able to go through the calculation of the tidal bulge, and putting in reasonable numbers show that the kind of rough order of magnitude change in height due to tides is about a meter. To do this, you need to know the mass of the Moon, and the thing to remember is that the mass of the gravitational force at the surface of the Moon, little g, is 1/6 of that on Earth. And I think that should be enough to calculate both the radius and mass of the Moon, assuming the Moon has the same density as the Earth, which is about 5 grams per cubic centimeter. So work through that and calculate the difference in tides. The key thing to do, I mean, in fact, the only thing to do that's at all tricky is you wind up with a bunch of square roots, and you want to Taylor expand the square roots to first order. So to first order, they all cancel out, that just giving the acceleration at the surface of the Earth, and all the tidal action is in the first order part, or, you know, the first term of the expansion. So to be a little more specific about how to go about this, you consider the Earth and the Moon, and calculate the net forces relative to an observer on Earth for a patch of water between the center of the Earth and the center of the Moon, a patch of water on the exact opposite side, away from the center of the Moon, and then at the north and south poles of the Earth. And what you find is that there is a bulge. If you want more specifics about how to do this problem, please ask. It's about 5 lines of calculation. It really isn't too bad. Another very big application of central force problems is scattering. And there's a lot of kinematics that goes into scattering that I'm not going to have time to cover in this podcast. And in fact, looking over the material, I think it's probably worth just having another one of these specialty podcasts just on scattering theory. What I would suggest is that you be sure you be able to work out Rutherford scattering by calculating the cross section. And to do that, I'll just give you the relation between scattering cross section and initial parameters. So the cross section, which has units of length squared, is equal to b divided by sine theta times the absolute value of db d theta, where b is the impact parameter. So there's the scattering center, which, say, lies along the z-axis. The incident particle comes along parallel to the z-axis, but some distance b away from the z-axis. From infinity, comes in and scatters off the particle via some central force interaction and leaves at an angle theta. So what you need to work out to calculate a cross-section is the relationship between impact parameter and theta. So I would do this for the Coulomb case, which is a 1 over r squared force, and the hard sphere case, which is just two spheres bump into each other with some impact parameter, and you calculate the angle that they come off, given that they hit with that impact parameter. And we'll talk more about scattering later on, but those are two problems that you should know and be pretty proficient with. Science news this week, there were a few things that really caught my attention. Last Thursday, Vladan Vuletic gave a colloquium, which I thought was really just fabulous. It was everything a colloquium should be. Vladan's a very measured speaker, but his choice of example, his posing of a couple of questions at the beginning that were intriguing, and also his references to some classic papers by, for example, Dickey, made it just a tremendous colloquium. And I recommend you look at his article in Science. His last name is Vuletic, which you should just be able to search for in Science. Another thing useful is in this week's Science, there is a reference to something called I Love Physics, www.ilovephysics.com, which is a place that contains a great number of physics examples with solutions. That might be a really good place for you to go if you're looking for problems to work on, which is always kind of a challenge to find good problems to work.
aside from that, not too much else happened this week. I did hear that, first of all, my colleague, Ulrich Becker, was nominated and appointed as a fellow of the American Physical Society, and that made me really happy, because that was really something that was much deserved. And the next day I found out that I had been made a fellow of the American Physical Society, which I don't deserve at all. Just goes to show, you know, you hang around long enough and you get recognized. That's it for this week. Next week will be a topical discussion on electricity and magnetism. I hope things are going well with your studying. Keep at it a half hour a day. At a certain point, I'll recommend that you ramp it up maybe to 45 minutes a day. Another thing you can do, if you're really feeling guilty about a half hour a day not being enough, here's a little suggestion. Choose the area that you really feel you're weakest on and get a good, relatively short, easy-to-read introductory book and read, again religiously, 5 or 10 pages a day. For example, many people are weak on thermodynamics, and there's a book by Pippard, P-I-P-P-A-R-D, which is just a fabulous book. It's about 150 pages long. If you read 5 pages a night, you'll finish it in a month, and you will have gone through a lot on thermodynamics. So the idea is to choose a book. Don't work any of the problems, because you're going to be doing that during your half hour, but just read it and get it fresh in your mind. Somebody once told me the key to general exams is kind of steeping in physics, like a tea bag steeps in hot water. So give that a try if you feel like you want to be doing something more. As always, I'd like to thank Bonna Newman at REFS and Homer Reed, as well as Sheila Holzer and her husband John Marston and Sean Thompson for all of the support. Sheila's been working on a new web page, which I think we'll get to you soon. And until then, I'll talk to you next week. Please send email to fisherp@mit.edu if there's anything you'd like me to cover. You don't have to be from MIT if you're listening to this somewhere else. Otherwise, have a good week, and enjoy Cambridge or wherever you are.